Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Photo with Catherine Hall and Leo Laporte. Episode 58, recorded May 22nd, 2012. Nordic Light, Part 1. TWiT Photo is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, visit Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWITPHOTO5. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For a 30-day free trial, visit Netflix.com/TWIT. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special TWIT Photo. Leo Laporte here. Catherine Hall, our host, is not here today, but she is in a way, so I'll explain. Catherine's actually right now at the G+C conference, the Google Plus conference, doing a photo walk and seminars in San Francisco. But this is a perfect time for us to do a two-part series today and next week about our trip to Norway. Catherine and I went to Norway for the amazing Nordic Light International Workshop of Photography in Kristiansund. What a great time we had. Kristiansund is a very small town, about 25,000 people, on the west coast of Norway, on the water there. And it was a perfect place to bring together some of the best photographers in the world, about 40 of them, to talk about their work, to lecture, to amazing exhibits. We just had a blast. And what we did there is we interviewed six of the best photographers in the group. So we're going to have three interviews this week, three interviews next week. This week we'll start off with the organizer, the guy who put the conference together, the great photographer Morten Krogvold. He'll be our first guest. Then after that, street photographer Bruce Davidson from the U.S., amazing, talented photographer, just really incredible. And then our third is a Brit named James Mollison, whose pictures of children and their bedrooms, you might remember, an amazing book that was put together with the United Nations to talk about children around the world and how they live in their conditions, some good, some not so good. James is a kind of a project-oriented photographer who does just work that will take your breath away. So all three of these are great photographers. I'd like to talk a little bit. In fact, I have some pictures of my own from Norway. We didn't get Catherine's pictures. This is us leaving in the airport. Catherine was there taking pictures, as all of us with her in our iPhone. This is Kristiansund itself, a beautiful town that is actually distributed among four different islands. We fly there. We flew to Oslo and then fly from Oslo to Kristiansund. You go over these beautiful mountain peaks on the way there, still covered with snow. The conference was at the end of April. Normally it's springtime, but as you can see, it was still a little bit chilly in Kristiansund. We went there because of the guy on the right. That's Mikkel Olin. And by the way, I apologize. I haven't processed these photos, so I haven't white balanced them yet. So these are a little overwarm. Mikkel has been on this show. He's a great photographer from the Bay Area, but he's also Norwegian. In fact, has a house in Norway. And has been very much a part of the Nordic Light Festival for the last couple of years and invited us to come this year. On the left, Odd Inga Taiga, who was our host there and one of the volunteers. They have 200 volunteers working the festival from Kristiansund, actually from all over Norway. And they make it an amazing experience. Odd Inga was such a great guy. We just became great friends with him. Kristiansund became a bustling seaport because of the Klippfisk. This is a statue in the port of a woman in her right hand. You probably can't see it. She holds, there it is, a dried cod. They would catch the cod and then dry them on the cliffs. That's the Klippfisk. And they still sell it today, the dried cod. In fact, you probably have had it as bacalhau, which is a great Portuguese treat. There's Catherine preparing for an interview, which we're going to see a little bit later, with James Mollison. We did all these interviews at different locales around Kristiansund. This one was on a ferry, one of the little ferry boats that plies the four islands going around. There's Lisa Kensel, who came with me, and we had such a great time overlooking the port. There's the little ferry you can see going from island to island. really beautiful, beautiful area. This reminded me a little bit of Vancouver with the mountains in the background and the harbor there. They serve, some of these big ships like that orange and red ship serve the oil platforms, which are out there in the North Sea. Norway was a very poor country after World War II until oil was discovered in the 60s, and now it is a very wealthy country. That's the little ferry boat. We took a ride. We went from island to island. It was so much fun. It's a 42 kroner to go all around, and it was a great time. Some of the photographers there were amazing. This is, and I'm going to get her name, I'm going to butcher her name. Unfortunately, we did not interview her. So she's an Afghani photographer, a very brave woman who came to the conference with her husband. Her name is Farzana Wahidi. I hope I'm saying that right. And Farzana and her husband were just an inspiration, because there's her husband on the right, who just won a Pulitzer Prize, by the way, for his photography in Afghanistan. They live in a war-torn country, but they are doing their best to document the life there. And I was very inspired by the two of them. And, you know, I regret not getting an interview with them, but maybe next time we will. There's Morten Odinga and Mikkel Olin. We're about ready to sail out to this little island. It's a vacation island just a few miles outside of Kristiansand called Grip. And it was a beautiful island. And unfortunately, Ryan Marsh, who was there with Catherine, our lighting guy, our gaffer, found this boom and decided to have a little bit of fun swinging out. I was terrified. Whoops, there we go. Terrified. He was swinging out over. Why would you do this, Ryan? Why? But I managed to capture it for posterity. And then, fortunately, he made it back to dry land safely. Then decided to do it again. That's Catherine and Lisa taking pictures. And, of course, being a boy, he couldn't resist showing off. And then Lisa, of course, couldn't resist doing it herself. So, great. The CEO of Twit decided to risk her life. There she is, swinging out over this, And there she is waving. She made it safe and sound. Grip was a beautiful little island. People have had their houses there for generations. And it feels like it's in the middle of the ocean. And I asked what storms were like, and they said, oh, it's not so bad. You know, just batten down the hatches. Here is Farzana and her husband in the little church in Grip, which is several hundred years old. The lighting there was quite beautiful. The photographers loved it. Morton's taking a picture of another photographer, Abe Frandlich, who he met and became great friends with. Abe is a wonderful photographer. We'll have him on Twit Photos sometime soon. Morton says he doesn't take pictures of any of the conference participants until this trip to Grip, which is at the very end of the conference, because he loves the light in this church so much. And it really is. It's a gorgeous place, and I can't wait to see Morton's pictures. You could see that Abe also had a point and shoot. He took a few pictures of Morton with his Hasselblad taking pictures like that. That's Greg Gorman, the Hollywood photographer, getting everybody got into the act. We couldn't resist. It was so beautiful. Morton, dramatic looking fellow. Now, again, I haven't processed these yet, but I think they're going to come out pretty well once I do. Here's one of the volunteers for the Nordic Light Festival, who also has a family home for three generations there. Those are the pictures of the different generations that have stayed on Grip during the summer. Beautiful view out their window. And she was complaining because her sisters own the house with her, and they will not let her upgrade the house. They say it's historic, and so she's stuck with an old kitchen. There's Mikkel and Catherine back from our trip. Julie Graham, who was another one of the curators there, photographic curator. She represents some very big photographers. With James Mollison's baby. He brought his two-month-old with him, and we had so much fun with him. This is the typical Norwegian dish. It's iPhone mit brat. No, I don't know. Somebody was eating. I don't know why they were doing this, but I couldn't resist taking a picture. Later, we took a boat. This was not Catherine and Lisa's favorite part, but we took a boat called the Hørte Grøte. Did I say that right, Odinga? The Hørte Grøte, which was a boat that went from Kristiansand to Bergen. And it tossed a little bit, but boy, we had a beautiful trip through the fjords. Just gorgeous views of the east coast of Norway. And we happened to have a perfect day for it as well. As you can see, crystal clear It was the best day, in fact, of the whole trip, weather-wise. And that's gorgeous aboard. Yes, it had, not only did it have indoor toilets, it's kind of like a cruise ship. There were people who had been on there for 2 weeks. They had cabins and everything. But for some reason, I never understood, they dried fish. Maybe it was just a display on the back of the boat. They were drying. The Norwegians love their dried fish. Here we are sailing into Bergen Harbor. Just a beautiful harbor. Bergen was it. There's Catherine, Lisa, and Ryan. And the dried fish, actually, on the poop deck. I believe that's the technical term for that. We also then took a train, and I don't have a whole lot of pictures from the train, but we took the train from Bergen back to Oslo through the middle of the Spoon of Norway and through the mountains. And you could see it was very snowy still. In fact, this is where the planet Hoth scenes from Star Wars Episode 4 were shot. And then back to the Oslo airport and home. We flew over the ice caps. Of course, you go over the polar caps. It's just amazing. So a wonderful trip, and I really want to thank everybody at the Nordic Light Festival for making that possible. We had a great time meeting some of the best photographers in the world. In fact, let's kick things off with Catherine's interview with the organizer of the Nordic Light Festival, Morten Krogvold.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Twit Photo at the Nordic Light Festival 2012. And we are here today with Morten Krogvold, one of the founders of the Nordic Light Festival. And why did you pick Kristiansund? Why here?
They picked me. So I was here doing a lecture. And it was a very cozy night. And 2 o'clock in the morning, they gave me the best red wine and said, could you run a festival here? And I said, of course, because I knew that it will never come true anyway. But they did.
So they gave you drinks and then they asked you.
Yeah,
and you said yes.
Yes.
And here we are today.
Yeah,
7 years.
7 years.
7 years. And how has the festival progressed?
It's absolutely wonderful. And you never imagine that success. And I can never experience that we could get hold on all the great photographers in the world. I think people are very curious to come to Norway and to the sea, coastline, and to this city. So I'm absolutely stunned. The response has been so wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, the legends that you've had. So many legends year after year.
The best.
So what is it about the Nordic light in itself, the light of this country?
I think it's an easy place to be. We call it the Big Hog Festival. And I think you snob down when you come to this labor city. And in Norway, we treat everybody the same, so it's easy to be here.
Yeah. What about the light itself, the quality?
The light is fantastic. It's a little too cold.
It lasts forever, doesn't it?
The sun. And the blue light in the evening is fantastic. Yeah. So the light is fantastic here, but I think the light is fantastic everywhere in the world.
Absolutely.
It depends.
Just different. Different qualities. Different qualities. So your photographic journey started very young, and you had quite an impressionable experience as a child in the hospital. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how it shaped your career later?
I was 2.5 years in the hospital because of a hip problem called calvae leg pertes in Greek. And I had to stay in bed for 2.5 years. And I couldn't read before I was 10. And then I looked at photographs because I couldn't read. So my father came and gave me books about photography, history photography. And I listened to radio. And I think I developed a fantasy because I had to bring a fantasy to survive in a way.
Yeah.
And that fantasy was actually black and white because it was black and white photography I saw. And then my brothers had darkroom and I felt like I was a failure as a kid. And the only thing I managed to do was to print in the darkroom. And that's the reason I became a photographer, I guess. So I hated school.
You hated school. Yeah. You hated school. So that was your refuge, in a sense.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned before that you found peace in the dark, the solitude, the dark solitude of the dark room.
Yeah.
Can you, I'm sure that has something to do with it, but can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, I'm always hunting for the light. Photography is to search for the light. And then you make the birth in the dark room, in a way. And the darkroom is a place for concentration and also to have a great time. I listen to music, I'm alone, I concentrate and I work with the silver prints. And I try to create the atmosphere I didn't get on the photograph. I push it a little more.
Yeah.
And to be in the darkroom is a fantastic experience. So I, in a way, I pity young photographers that they're only into digital, because they should also be in the darkroom, because it's so fantastic to be there.
It is. Yeah. It's a different experience.
Yeah, yeah. It's different.
And do you shoot? Yeah, you're shooting still in film.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
Do you do anything digital?
A little color. It's fantastic. But I think it's something with film that appeals to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm used to it, so I will never switch to digital in black and white. But in color, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
But I shoot 90% black and white.
You shoot black and white. Yeah. So there you go. There's something about the green quality.
Yeah. And you know, the very famous photographer Helmut Newton, he was once asked, he did all these sexy fashion things. Mm-hmm. And he was asked by a journalist that, "Your light remind me of the Nazi propaganda films in the 30s in Berlin." And he said, "Of course, I was a young kid in Berlin."
Yeah. Mm.
So I think it's about your childhood, the impression you had as a child. And for me, I looked at all these fantastic black and white photographs in Life magazine.
Yes.
Yeah. Because that was the Life magazine.
Well, that was your refuge when you were in the hospital.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And you talked about that you feel emotionally amputated working on a computer.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit more detail?
No, I think for me, I like the physical thing. So the computer
you like to use your hands.
Yeah. So the computer did just, you know, I'm a little bored sitting in front of the computer. After 10 minutes, I'm a little restless. So
yeah.
I need to touch the paper. I need to work with my body in a way. And and I'm a technical, absolutely idiot.
So what do you suggest for young photographers that are growing up in this generation?
Do both.
Well, let's just say they're not going to do both. They are going to stick with the computer. How do they connect? Like you're talking about, there's that sort of raw connection, that real using your hands, being a part of the process. How can you achieve that in the digital era?
It's different. So I think you miss something when you're not if you're not doing analog photography. But the digital is absolutely fantastic, no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But it's I think it's very difficult for young photographers, because the first thing, they're influenced by the whole world. They see everything on the internet, everything. And then they're working so much on the computer that it's hard to be personal. And it's a very famous Norwegian composer. He died a couple of years ago. And he said, "When I'm composing very modern music, I have to have the pencil direct to the musical score. With nothing between it.
Yeah.
To feel the surface of the paper." That's very important. But the digital is the future. But still, I think many photographers still going to work in the darkroom. But absolutely both.
Yeah.
Both.
So you would recommend for emerging photographers to, at least, if they're going to do digital, fine, but at least take a class.
Absolutely.
Or at least experience what it is to create prints, to watch them come to life in a dark room.
Because I think you learn so much about Photoshop by doing darkroom work.
Oh,
because
then
it's a basic thing. And then you understand more when you go to the computer. So I don't see any difference. I think both is fantastic.
Yeah. Mm. And it's interesting you were talking about, there's so much information.
Yeah.
And I think, in a lot of ways, that can help photographers grow, but in other ways, it can stifle them, because how do you find your own voice when you're so inundated with information? How do you feel about that?
I think you are really talking on the most important field in photography, to find your own voice. Kieslowski, the Polish film director, said once that when I see the old masters, I see them standing in front of standing in the churchyard, ready to be buried. And out in the big road, it's a lot of beautiful cars driving, and they are all the same. And that's the future of film, he meant. And I think it's very difficult to find your own voice in photography. The thing I did, I wrote down, I'm writing every night. I wrote down, what kind of music do I love? What kind of literature? What kind of photography? What kind of painting? And if that connects, if the books I read, the music I hear, the photographs I see, the painting I see, if they connect, then you're on the right track. And for me, it's very easy, because my music is Gustav Mahler, it's Mozart, it's Bach, it's Beethoven, Shostakovich. My film taste is Scandinavian, Russian, Tarkovsky, and the books I read is Dostoevsky, Knut Hamsun. So it's easy because I know that I'm searching for this melancholy mood.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not a sad person. But Samuel Beckett said once that imagine that you have a black sun inside you that is more interesting than the bright sun outside. The bright sun is a fantastic thing to be enjoying, but in the black sun, that's the creative source.
Yeah.
I think all art, in a way, deals with sorrow and sadness and death, even the funny things.
Yeah.
It's serious stuff.
So how do you tap into that source, that dark sun that you call
because
it?
I have conversation with myself. So I ask myself questions. The whole idea for me is to find out why am I doing photography. And then I have to ask myself questions, and I do it, and I write down the answers. Every day I ask myself questions, and every day I write down what I think to find out why am I doing this. And
why are you doing this?
Yeah.
What do you write down?
I write down that I'm doing this to look at myself, how I deal with life. In a way, I'm checking out myself. I'm checking off if I'm alive. I mean, mentally alive. That's the first thing. And then I have to express something, because we are all totally alone in the world. Even if you're married, we are children, we are alone. And in a way, we have a sadness and a sorrow. And I think you have to go down to that source. All the great novelists do that.
Yeah.
I mean, all the great filmmakers, and not entertaining filmmakers, but I mean the art filmmakers, you go down to the black sun, and that helps you to be in good mood.
Yeah.
Because you can have all this melancholy out and into the photograph, and then you're free to enjoy life.
So it's true expression in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's probably your attraction to music, and loud music at that, I hear.
Yeah, loud classical music.
Do you sing in the dark room ever?
No. I listen to Mahler and Wagner, and I'm crazy. You know. I enjoy... I don't know if you are familiar with Gustav Mahler's music.
Absolutely.
That's for me photography, because it's something in that sad mood that makes me happy. And art that is made to make me happy make me sad.
I think
it's too much entertainment. And Roger Waters he said once that this beach is going to amuse itself to death.
Yeah,
because it's entertaining. All entertaining. All music, everything in the radio is good. But pop music, and it's noise, and it's entertaining. I'd be crazy.
You've mentioned before that fashion.
Yeah.
You know, the trends in fashion, in a sense, have that sort of surface level. Yeah.
If you marry, marry the trends, you get divorced very soon.
I like that concept. Yeah, I want to end with that. Can you explain how does one create a timeless image?
I think a timeless image is an image that can be seen in 100 years from now or 50 years from now. And then the timeless image comes from here and not from there. It comes from yourself, and you meet yourself. You see, I have a scene, but you have to involve yourself. But I think it's about self-discovery. Actually, I think photography is about self-discovery. And if you're not willing to do that, you can be a fashion photographer and you can do a lot of fancy stuff, but it's actually about self-discovery. That's the reason we are doing this. crazy craft.
So if you don't put yourself 100%, if you don't immerse, if you don't let go, if you don't express.
Yeah. No, then I think you could stay on the track for a couple of years and then you will be out.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Twit Photo. This is Morten Kalkvold on Twit Photo at Nordic Light Festival 2012. Mm. And if you're not here this year, don't miss the next year, right? Thank you very much. We'll see you on the next one.
That's Morten Kalkvold and Catherine Hall, an interview. And I'm trying to remember where they did that interview. I didn't go. Where was that they did that interview? I can't remember. But anyway, Morten's stuff is just fantastic, as you saw some of his pictures. A true artist. And I love the line, if you marry fashion, you'll be divorced quickly. Coming up next, a photographer whose work is in the Museum of Modern Art. He's one of the best American photographers, the best known, brilliant photographer. And we had such a good time talking, Bruce Davidson. In just a moment, we'll show some of his pictures as well. But I do want to remind everybody that this show is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Squarespace, the secret behind truly exceptional websites. Everything you need, the best hosting ever. You cannot bring a Squarespace site down. Totally secure because they also do the software. And by doing the software and the hosting, they can keep an eye on security. They keep it locked down. You never have to worry about updating it. You never have to worry about protecting it. It's done for you. And I love that. Why spend a lot of energy thinking about the back end on a website? Focus on your content. That's what Squarespace lets you do. You go to Squarespace right now and squarespace.com. Click that green try it free button. You don't need a credit card. You just try it for 2 weeks. You get the full range of Squarespace tools, including their incredible artist designed templates, the photo galleries, the stats, posting via Android and iPhone. They've got a great iPad app that let you not only post but moderate, check your stats. Squarespace is truly remarkable. And now, at a very remarkable price, they've changed the pricing. So sign up free, try it. If you decide to buy as little as $8 a month for an annual plan, I recommend the unlimited $16 plan. I mean unlimited everything, pages, bandwidth, and storage. For $16 a month. That is incredible. And when you sign up for either annual plan, they will automatically register a domain name for you. That's worth $15. And set it up so that that domain name goes directly to your Squarespace site. They do all the work for you. This is such a great deal. You might want to do that now because we've got a special offer code, TwitPhoto and the number 5, TwitPhoto 5. And you'll get 10% off your first purchase. And if that's an annual plan, that makes a significant difference in the cost. Very affordable, very powerful. Take a look at the example sites to see why people who use Squarespace love it. Not only is it reliable, but no Squarespace site looks like any other. You don't want to look like a cookie-cutter site. You want your own personality to shine through. Great for photographers. Squarespace.com. Try it free today, and when you decide to buy, don't forget to use the offer code TWITPHOTO5. To save 10% on your first purchase. We thank Squarespace for supporting us. The Odinga says that interview with Morten Kalkvold was shot in a 140-year-old fishing canoe in the Fishing History Museum in Kristiansund. Okay. Well, I feel kind of bad. This next interview, we took Bruce Davidson up to one of the highest points in Kristiansund, a beautiful old restored, I guess it's a lighthouse. And it was a bit of a hike, but boy, did we have a spectacular view. Let me tell you a little bit about Bruce Davidson before we go to that interview. Since 1958, he's been working for Magnum, the photo service Magnum. Magnum has supported him in creating some truly amazing photo essays, mostly street photography. His photographs have been shown at the Museum of Modern Art. He has done portraits of people like Marilyn Monroe, Leonard Bernstein, Andy Warhol, and Jack Kerouac. His Brooklyn Gang series is world famous and was used on a Bob Dylan album cover a couple of years ago, Together Through Life. He is truly an inspiration to me, and you'll see we're going to show he has his original Leica camera that he shot most of these photos with him, and it's truly a beautiful thing. It's not a lighthouse. What is it, Odinga? It's a tower on a hill. I'm not sure what it was. Take a look. Bruce Davidson at the Nordic Light Photographic Festival.
We brought Bruce Davidson to the highest point in Kristiansund to celebrate the fact that you take pictures underground many times. Yeah. It is such an honor to have you on our show.
Thanks.
I thank you so much. You've taken so many, you know, the word that Catherine used is iconic pictures. Pictures that once you see them, you never forget them. We see them again and again. Mm-hmm. What launched your quest? What is it that drove you from the beginning to take pictures?
I think that it's kind of a boyhood passion for photography as I knew it as I was growing up in the formative years of my life.
Did you have a Brownie? Or
I started out with a Brownie. And yeah. I've collected all my cameras through the ages. You know, I have them all.
You have actually the Leica M2 that you used to shoot those
1959.
Famous pictures in New York. Yeah, the gang, the gang pictures. Yeah. So you have them all still?
I have all but one, which I'm looking for.
What is it?
My mother was a single parent, and when she became remarried, she married a commander in the Navy, and they were issued during the Second World War Kodak medalist cameras, which was like a large Leica, a beautiful camera. And her husband gave me the camera that he had had during the Second World War. And it was wonderful. And some of the photographs survived that I took at that time. They're in my retrospective book. So it was having a good camera and having the freedom. And, of course, our life changed when my mother married this very generous man.
How old were you when you had the medalist?
I was 15. And I was allowed to go into the city from Oak Park, Illinois, where we lived, as long as I'm returned by dark.
Huh.
So I would explore things in Chicago, underneath the L, the Wrigley Building lit up at night. A woman wearing a bushka in a flea market. You know, the things that I met my eye at that time.
It's amazing that you still have pictures you took when you were 15.
Yeah, right.
Has your eye changed? It sounds like you had an eye then.
An eye is all attached to the brain.
Yeah.
And the brain is attached to the spirit.
Yeah.
And the spirit is there. So, sure, you know. I learned a lot by just being off by myself.
Yeah.
In Chicago.
Yeah. You like cities, obviously.
Well, I like everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I like it, I like it.
Do you get obsessed? You did a series of nature pictures in Central Park. Do you get obsessed with the idea?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, I also became very obsessed when I did the New York subway. I became a werewolf. Like, I could hear the rumble of the subway below our apartment, and I would jump out of bed when I could feel myself being compelled to get into the tunnel of the subway again.
It drew you.
Yeah, well, I think any artist or any person has to be passionate and focused to create a body of work, whatever it is. I don't care if it's nailing a nail in the wood.
Right.
But I think passion is important.
The pictures that you took in the 70s of the subway were when it was at its worst, as you say, grimy and dangerous. Mm-hmm. But you found a beauty there that's very interesting because it's kind of counterintuitive. It seems so dirty and ugly, and yet it's beautiful.
Yeah, there's layers of life in there. And then that was one of the challenges in the subway, is to know where I was psychologically, artistically. You know, I see something that was a color that was a beautiful color juxtaposed with another beautiful color, and then a person's sitting in front of these beautiful colors wearing a beautiful jacket or T-shirt. It was all that counterpuntal thing that drove me through the subway. You know, it was a life. It was a canvas.
Yeah. And initially black and white, and then you started doing color.
Yeah, I found black and white, and then I found a meaning in color, a color meaning. In other words, a dimension of understanding that only could be derived through color photography. And, you know, color photography wasn't new to me, and neither was color, because I studied when I was at Yale University, I studied with Joseph Albers in his color course. Mm. So I knew what color was, how to think about color.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your? I went to Yale as well. What was your course of study at Yale?
I was a philosophy major, and I also was in Joseph Albers' drawing and color course.
Very famous courses. Yeah.
It really changed my life.
But as a boy, you were a photographer. Did you know you wanted to be an artist?
I didn't know what the word. You know, where I come from, we don't have that word in our vocabulary. You know, he's that weird kid. He has that box, a camera, and he's taking pictures. That's, why isn't he on the football team? You know, that guy. That, you know, to get dates in high school in the Midwest in the 50s, you had to either be an athlete, or a musician, or a photographer.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I was a photographer, I was introduced to.
You can meet girls.
Right.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah. Now, you also met gang members. In fact, your wife, Emily, has now done a book. Tell us about that, the follow-up.
Well, that was an interesting dynamic because after a year with the Brooklyn Gang, I sort of forgot about them, you know, basically. 40 years later, we got a phone call from the leader, and I thought it was a shakedown, okay? And Emmy said, I'm coming with you. You're not going to see this guy alone. So she did. And his life was amazing because after 1959, he became a notorious drug dealer. He became a millionaire. But he also was an user and an abuser and lost everything. Mm-hmm. He had five wives. He lost everything. And then found his way back. And today, he's a drug counselor, treating... Some of the old members of the gang are still on heroin, and they're 65 years old.
Wow.
One just died. So Emily picked up on that, and over a period of almost 10 years, he would come over every Saturday.
Wow.
You know, I wouldn't let her, she doesn't know this, but I wouldn't let her in the apartment alone with this guy.
I don't blame you.
So I had our dark room is right next to our kitchen. Yeah, yeah. So I was in the dark room printing while he was giving her exploits in his life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that unusual for you to follow up on somebody from years later?
It's unusual. It has to have an accident. I don't generally look for people. People emerged.
Well, they see the pictures probably.
Yeah, they see the picture. Someone tells them about it. Yes, it's happened to me a number of times.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. When you go out, when the subway called to you, do you go out saying, there's something I want to get, or do you go out with a completely open mind?
No, sometimes I go out with... frozen with fear. and what I use to drive myself in back into the subway is hunger. I get myself very hungry. And then I say, I think I'll go out to Coney Island and have a hot dog. And that's an hour on the subway. I never make it. But it gets me in there and gets me thinking about the hot dog and not the guy who's going to rob me.
Right. Because it was scary.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have some favorite images that you look back and say, I nailed it? Or like many artists, you always say, oh, I could have done that one a little bit better.
Well, you're never finished.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I re-edited the entire 350 boxes of slides, and I found 20 pictures that I knew I had, but I wasn't ready for them yet. Sometimes an image is ahead of your consciousness. And I intuitively knew that I had made a photograph of something that was important to be seen, but I wasn't quite ready with it.
Hmm.
It was beyond me.
So you put it aside.
I put in my brain, yes, and then I see it again, you know. And it happens to me over and over again that even as an editor, and I'm a pretty good editor of my work, I wasn't ready to exploit that image into another body of work.
Interesting, yeah. But you somehow knew that there was something there.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, that's one of the things we, much lesser mortals, have difficulty with is editing our own work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? How do you know when you look at an image that's the right
Sometimes
image?
Sometimes I don't. Sometimes there are two images so close together, and I can't decide on which one.
Yeah.
Then I call in my wife. It's a wife thing. And then I call in my assistant. And between the two of them, they'll show me the light.
Yeah. Yeah.
Show me the light. And that happens quite a bit.
It's helpful to have other eyes. But you sound like you know when you look at your images for the most part.
I do now.
Not originally?
I do now. I mean, I think I do now because I'm at the age now where I'm beginning to see more in depth.
Right.
You know, I don't see as sharply, maybe, but yeah. I see more out of knowledge, out yeah. of experience.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm also distant from what I did.
Right.
And so I can see into it.
Right.
And find myself again. And that's important.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm in love with palm trees. I know it sounds crazy, and I am. I'm the tallest palm in L.A. I'm in love with. We're going to date it, you know.
Maybe it's a date palm.
It's a date palm, yes. But the thing is, these are misunderstood, misappreciated urban trees.
Well, they're in a completely foreign setting for the palm tree.
Oh, yes. They were brought over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
They only lived to be about 100.
So these are 100 feet tall.
They're huge. And they're only held by roots a meter in diameter.
Wow.
I could not realize. And so the city of Los Angeles is not selling seeds for or planting any new
right.
palms of that size.
Right.
So I take it upon myself to preserve that lyrical loveliness that yeah. these palms have. They don't give off shade.
Right.
They're too tall.
Right.
They don't give coconuts.
Right.
They don't enter in photosynthesis to any degree. There's nothing for them, and they're in an alien urban desert environment, and they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And without a palm tree, I wouldn't go to L.A. anymore. So I'm involved with the nature and the dynamic between nature and the city.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm exploring.
The New Yorker just did a piece on you, the Santa Monica parking lot.
Right.
Which
right.
just lined with cars and then the beach and then the ocean.
Right.
It's quite an image.
I call that the Los Angeles flag. You know, it's like Spumoni.
Stripes.
With three layers. You know, it's sun, sea, parking lot, and pollution.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's also a beautiful photograph in itself.
It is.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's beautifully printed in the exhibit.
They did a very nice job.
That print, I hadn't seen that print in that size.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it really is.
So you still shoot with the M2 or?
This is my...
This camera has seen some...
Yeah, this is a camera I could take to a cocktail party.
I love it.
But
it's gorgeous.
Right now, I have a number of Leica cameras over the years.
Yeah.
But this is still my favorite one because it has my DNA.
You told a story about shooting a picture of a guy in the subway, kind of scary-looking guy with a
scar.
And I don't know if it was the that Leica, but you had the camera and you started to take... He said, don't take a picture of me.
Yeah, right. Right.
How'd you convince him?
Oh, I carried a album in with me, a little 5x7 gold trim wedding album with a selection of my pictures. And I wanted to photograph him, and I always carry the camera open.
You don't hide it?
I don't hide it.
Yeah.
No. A little bit at 2 in the morning, I had it like a poncho.
Yeah.
You know, it's there.
Yeah.
But I never hid it. And looked at him, he looked at me, and he said, if you thinking about taking my picture, I'm going to break your camera. I said, wait a minute, I have an album. I never photograph people without their permission. And he looked through the album and he said, you do good work, you can take my picture. So I went back to where I was sitting and photographed him. And that was a transitional day because the graffiti growing out of his head like
yeah.
Medusa had a meaning with this, and it married very well with the cut in his face.
It was like the thoughts coming out of his head.
Exactly. It's
yeah.
like a hieroglyphics. Anyway, that moment I switched over to color.
I saw both. There's
yeah.
a black and white, and then there's a
yeah,
color image
right.
of him.
I carried two cameras.
Yeah. Because of the graffiti?
Yeah, the graffiti suddenly became important to me.
Yeah.
You know, it was yeah. more than just a picture of someone sitting in a car.
Yeah.
It had something about it that was decoding.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah. I just want to thank you so much for your time, Bruce, and for this hike up this hill, and Emily, too, for this hike.
Well, it's going down that we're concerned about.
We'll just roll you down.
Yeah, we'll just roll us. Stay here for the night.
It's actually it's quite a spectacular spot.
I think that another notion, that the you know, I have been a a documentary photojournalist, let's say. But now my work has begun, and I can't be conscious of it, is in the realm of art, whatever that means.
Right.
But it's the art of history, not the history of art, that I'm interested in.
The art of history.
Yeah, the art of photographing what's before us at a certain time and place in our culture and our life. Okay? Then, but you know what you're confronting are a lot are art historians. You know, they're interested in the history of imagery.
You know?
Where I'm interested in the history of history.
Yeah.
In the imagery of history, see? So there is a level of understanding that's come changing in my work. People are beginning to acquire my photographs as art, you know.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't care as long as the checks come. You know, no, that's good. People are appreciating my work.
They're appreciating it.
It's not just a picture of a subway card.
Right. It's not a magazine photo. This is art. This is something important.
Yeah, and art can be in a magazine, as in a New Yorker. So a different, something different is happening. Also, I can't lose sight of the fact that my work is being made in a certain time and place.
Yes.
Like I'm interested in polar bears, for instance. You know, I really am. Just as I was interested and am interested in the foliage and the meaning of foliage in the city environment. That's also documentary photojournalistic. So I don't use these labels.
Right.
I'm an activist to a point.
Right.
We have a daughter who's a real activist in photography. Spent 6 months in Cuba.
Right.
So way in the boondocks. But I would never do that. You know, I never would try to prove anything. I would let it happen.
No, it strikes me when I talk to great artists that it is almost an obsessive pursuit. You're doing something. You may even not consciously know what you're doing, but you're working on something, and you become obsessed with that, and you continue. Is that how it is for you?
Yeah, you become obsessed. You're still the boy of 15 with a camera and a freedom to leave his mother's womb.
That's great. We'll end on that note. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay,
thank you so much.
He was just a gentleman, and Emily, his wife, was so great, and they walked up a steep hill and climbed that tower. And it was a beautiful view, but boy, what a beautiful man. One of my new heroes, Bruce Davidson. I hope you enjoyed that interview. We're talking to some of the photographers that we met in Norway at the Nordic Light Festival. What a great photographic event that was, bringing together several dozen of the best photographers from all over the world, Scandinavia for sure, but from all over the world. And we've got a number of interviews, six in all, from that festival. Next, we're going to talk to James Mollison, who does some amazing pictures. He works in projects. He did pictures of great apes to show that they're all different and unique. His most recent project, Where Children Sleep, was the subject of his show at the Nordic Light Festival, and it's very dramatic. We'll take a look at some of those photos with Catherine's interview of James Mollison. Next week, we're going to talk to Greg Gorman, who is a Hollywood photographer. In fact, his picture, you've probably seen many of his pictures, but his picture of Michael Jackson with a tarantula on his face is one of the amazing shots, most amazing shots I've ever seen. Also, we're going to talk to Mary Ellen. I always forget her last name. Help me out, Tony. Mary Ellen Mark, thank you. Terrible. Terrible. Mary Ellen Mark, whose photographs you will instantly recognize. They're iconic. And then my interview with Robert Pledge, who has an agency, Contact Press Images. He is not a photographer. He's a curator. He's a photo editor. And the show that he did at the Nordic Light Festival was a mirror of a show he had done in China, where this was quite an interesting idea. He shows the contact sheet, something we don't have anymore, of the shots sent back from the photojournalists in the field, whether at 9/11 or in Vietnam, and you could see every image that was shot. You get the context, and then you see the ones that Robert Pledge picked himself, you could see they jump out at you. They're amazing. So we'll talk a little bit about the process of photo editing, and also why he believes photography is dead. That's next week. We've got three more great interviews from the Nordic Light Festival. James Mollison coming up in just a second. But first, a word from Netflix, one of our great sponsors. I know you're all Netflix users, members. Netflix is great for people who love photography because they have unusual films that are really truly photographic that you may not have seen in ages. I particularly point you to some of the documentaries on here. Here's Bill Cunningham, a street photographer, brilliant street photographer from New York. They've got Banksy's Exit Through the Gift Shop. It is a really great resource for people who love movies. And TV shows, too. Tens of thousands of movies, TV shows you can watch in an instant just by clicking your mouse. And get this, the price, $7.99 a month. But we can make it even better. Your first month is free. Oh, The Walking Dead. Yeah. The Twilight Zone. Those are black and white original seasons. Amazing. Just go to Netflix.com/twit. Netflix.com/twit and sign up. You get the first month free. You can try it out. Tell your friends and family, too. I know most of you are already Netflix subscribers. But if you're not, do us a favor. Netflix.com/twit. And if you are, tell a friend for your 30-day trial. We thank Netflix for their support. Let's go back to Norway for Catherine's interview with an amazing British photographer named James Mollison. We did this one in one of the ferries that plies the waters of Christensen. It goes around and around and around. Just a little tip. This one's on dry land. And if you watch carefully, I think at one point you will see the Hurtigruten sail by in the background. Catherine Hall and James Mollison from Christensen.
So here we are with James Mollison on one of the oldest ferries in Christensen. And I have to say, I saw your exhibit for the first time last night, Where Children Sleep, and it was by far one of my favorites amongst other brilliant work. Just so incredibly moving, so simple, such an easy, simple concept, but so brilliant. How did you come up with it? How did it all begin?
It began because I was asked to come up with an idea for UNICEF's 60th anniversary. And as I kind of began to think about how to photograph children from kind of impoverished countries in a kind of a different engaging way, I kind of looked back at existing photos that charities used. And I think they often use these very smiley photos or photos of kids looking kind of quite dejected. And I think I kind of was always aware that they worked on this very emotive level, but I kind of thought I actually end up knowing nothing about the kids. So I then thought back and I thought about what would have happened if I'd photographed myself when I was like 8 or 9? How would have you known a little bit more about you? Because with a portrait, you can only say so much. So I thought if you'd seen my bedroom, you would also know that was the one space in the house I was allowed to make my own. So maybe you would understand more about their lives if I also photographed their bedroom.
Yeah, definitely. And when you were starting this project, did you know, I mean, how did you pick which countries to start in, what origins?
Well, what happened was I came up with this idea, and another thing that was important for me was not just to photograph kids in, let's say, sub-Saharan Africa, in Bangladesh and countries like that, the main places that charities work. I thought that there's often this sense when you look at photos from those countries or places like Darfur that it looks like this hell on earth. So I thought for me it was very important also to photograph Western kids along with kids in those situations. And I actually proposed the project and they said they didn't like it. So, uh-huh. And it didn't go ahead. So I then kind of had this in my idea and I actually thought, this is actually quite a good idea. So I kind of began to photograph it on myself. And it was quite organic, the process. So I might be on a job somewhere, I would stay on and photograph, or there were places I felt that Israel and Palestine or the West Bank were interesting, so I went specifically for the project. But and later on I started to work with Save the Children and they wanted me to go to Nepal. So it was quite an organic process, but when I felt that I kind of had a glimpse of the world, you know, that I'd been to enough places, that was kind of when I felt I was done with it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think about it, the context of having that diversity is actually what makes it so powerful, in the sense of if it was just impoverished children, it would become you become a bit immune and it becomes sort of redundant in a sense. But having that sort of that diversity and that contrast allows you to see
what you're really looking at and experience it. I love the captions. You know, when I first walked up to him, I'm lazy when it comes to reading, and this is a lot of text, and I just found myself so involved in reading the captions. Are you doing those yourself, or do you have someone helping you with that?
Well, I work with Amber, my wife. She came on all the trips, on all of the trips with me, and I don't know, I just felt that kind of photography, again, it was this kind of layers of information. So you have the portrait that tells you something about the kid, and I wanted that to be on a plain background, so they were kind of treated equally. Then you have the bedroom, which lets you read a little bit of their life. But then I wanted to have these short texts, which would, you know, just tell the kind of quite basic things. They're quite simply done. We did them with kind of children in mind, because I think that the project has that strength where it helps children to kind of engage with issues as well, because they obviously have their own bedroom. So the texts were really just kind of adding that, those extra layers of information. And the last thing I'll say about them, I think also each kid was really chosen with the idea that they told a story about a particular situation. So mm-hmm. there is a real idea that there's a kind of journey through these kind of lives of children around the world, and they're kind of very diverse. So from somebody who's working as a child labourer in a stone quarry to kind of quite kind of successful New Jersey kids, you know, it's a kind of each kid tells a different story.
And then did you ever consider, I mean, I personally love the fact that it is not engaged in new media, that it is the text and it is looking at these contrasting photos. But did you think about getting live captions and doing multimedia? And how did you decide on sticking with just pure text and image?
Rather than make it more, I don't know. I mean, I suppose just I've kind of worked with books before. It's kind of what I know, really.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think that I really still enjoy the kind of engagement that you can have with a book, the kind of physical thing. So that's always my kind of first concern. And then I'll kind of think to any kind of new media applications after that.
Got it. And then I noticed always having a white background. Are you carrying these white backgrounds with you? And are you use strobe a lot too, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think I quite often use this typological way of working, and so I always am looking for a kind of consistency in the work that I do. And I think with the white background, I felt that it was important to kind of really strip the context of the kids away from the portraits. And I mean, I think as a photographer also, I'd seen projects where people had done kids in their bedrooms. And I think you're always searching to do it in a slightly different way. And I think that this gave this idea of, you know, we're all born equal, and that's a great statement, but actually it's completely untrue. So you had this idea that the kids are treated equally on the white background, and then the bedroom kind of talks about the inequality that exists.
Yeah, definitely. And then I noticed the lighting's very consistent, and going back with the born equal, kind of mm-hmm. keeping things very consistent throughout. But you're carrying strobe. What made you choose? Is it for the consistency using strobe? Because I know you're going to these countries where it must be hard to carry all the gear.
Yeah, it's for consistency, yeah.
And then what are you carrying, and how are you keeping your stuff safe in these not always safe environments?
I don't know. I am carrying a lot of equipment. I kind of take a couple of, you know, pro photo battery with a couple of strobes. I shot most of that on 4x5 film.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, and some of the places were quite remote, so you are kind of having to walk with it all as well. So, I don't know, it's just it's the way I work. So I don't even for me, it's never even a consideration whether I'm taking it with me. I'm always just taking that around with me. I'm kind of used to carrying that kind of stuff around with me. Safety, I don't know. For a start, the bags are so heavy, nobody's going to pick them up and run off with them anyway. And it's kind of, what would somebody do with it, really? I mean, I've never had anything stolen, touch wood.
Yeah. Yeah. And then how are you coming up with the formula? And when you know you have it, how do you know it's the right one to stick with?
I think that's always, for me, it's that first process of, like, what are you doing? Like, I set out quite tight rules for what I'm going to do, and then I follow that through the whole project. So, you know, here it was the white background, it was the bedrooms vertically, you know, which was frustrating because, you know, it's more natural to shoot a bedroom horizontally. But, you know, I knew that they were working with a portrait image. So it's really just about kind of seeing it through and following it through the rules that I set at the beginning of the project.
Yeah, that's interesting because I didn't even think about the fact that you are forced in that format to do the vertical, which is difficult with a bedroom. So you've done a lot of you work in series, which has become quite evident, which I think is really just beautiful and brilliant. But what is it about series that intrigues you versus a single image?
I think that what a series does, I think a single, I mean, for me, single images aren't really that important because in a way, the story comes through the repetition. So the first time I used it was when I did the book James and Other Apes, which was 50 portraits of chimpanzees, gorillas and orangutans. And that was really, I mean, that came about because I was looking at their faces and I was thinking that they're like human faces. But I thought, how do you kind of look at them as individuals? So I thought of this idea that we all use passport photos. So I thought, if I make passport photos of the great apes, you're really going to see them as the kind of their faces changing. So that was the first time I used it properly. And it's really, it was kind of shooting 80 gorillas and chimpanzees exactly the same way. I didn't want them smiling. I didn't want them pulling faces. Mm-hmm. And I think that that project was really the kind of first one that I followed through rigorously, and then I've kind of just followed it through with other ones I've done.
And how did you see, I think it's interesting how you were talking about how people respond, children and adults responded to the images differently. How did you find that? You know, you talked about the inspiration being seeing that similarity between us and apes. Did you feel that children made that connection differently than adults, and how so?
Well, one thing I notice is I've seen quite a few kids like flick through the book, and what's interesting is kids will kind of joke and they'll quite often say, oh, they'll find themselves. They'll find, I say, that one looks like me. Whereas adults will quite often flick through the book and then they'll say, oh, that looks like you. Or, you know, there's that kind of, you know, they kind of a joke. So the kids kind of, you know, I've seen quite a few cases, you know, where they really, you know, they kind of want to see themselves within the apes' faces.
And then the adults see
adults, it's more of a joke. It's like, that looks like you, you know, they kind of, but they don't kind of, they don't pick themselves out within the book.
Yeah. I think with all of your projects, one of the things that is most astounding is the access that you get. And I know with the ape story, you chose to, instead of going to a zoo or working with tamed apes or tamed animals, you went out into the wild and seeked real, and you weren't using long lenses. You want to do short lenses and get close and intimate. Can you tell me about that? How, you know, you make it hard on yourself. You carry a 4x5, you bring the big strobes, you're traveling to all these places. How do you get the access that you get?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that we're so bombarded with images now in the kind of culture. I mean, they're everywhere, that as a photographer, if you want to do something that people will give a second look at, you have to do something that's a little bit different or a little bit special. And, you know, with the apes, when I had this idea for the passport ones, but then I was thinking I wanted them to be proper portraits. And I knew that with a long lens, I wasn't going to be able to get that because there wouldn't be any kind of engagement. So at the beginning, I'd never photographed any animals before, except for, you know, kind of a few snaps of my cat. But I began to write away to places and ask if I could go. And I got really actually not just negative responses, but quite hostile responses, kind of like, you can't make a monkey sit for a portrait. And I knew that I didn't want to be involved in anything cruel. And at the same time, I'd been reading a book about an exploring Congo, and he'd been given a couple of these orphan gorillas, and I'd seen him holding them in the book. So I knew that there was a way if I could get access. So I eventually had an assignment in Berlin, and Berlin Zoo let me photograph this little gorilla called Shanga. And I got this one image and I thought, this is good. It's, you know, it's something that does work, because you can sometimes have these ideas and then, you do the picture and it doesn't work. And I thought, this one works. So on that, I risked a trip to Cameroon and started to get the gorillas and the chimpanzees. So I don't know. I mean, with access was difficult. I mean, it was difficult with that because it was also difficult because we share a lot of their same diseases. So there's a real reason for them not letting people go in with the animals. And also it's dangerous. But, you know, I eventually got it. And I mean, again, with that project, I finished it. I'd been wanting to get the bonobos in Congo, and I'd been writing to the place for 2 years. I'd written 8 times and I just didn't hear anything back. And I just thought, I'm just going to go. So I just kind of bought a ticket to Kinshasa and turned up.
And you, that's something you do, right? Yeah. Like, well, if you don't get a permit, you don't get a, you just go anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes I did it and it succeeded. The same happened in Atlanta. I tried to go to photograph some of the bonobos that do the sign language there, and they didn't respond to me. So I just turned up, and in that case, they wouldn't let me photograph them. So, you know, some you win and some you lose.
And how do you avoid beating yourself up when you put yourself out there? Do you just say, look, you know you're going to win some, you know you're going to lose some, or do you get disappointed, or how does that process work for you?
I think you've just got to have a little bit of confidence and know that sometimes sometimes it doesn't work out, and that's fine as well.
Yeah. And now I know that you have put yourself in risky situations a lot through all your projects. Now that you have a 2-month-year-old little boy, does that change anything for you?
Yeah, I think it probably does. I mean, you know, I want to shoot. I was looking at some of the work, you know, the other work, and it made me think, you know, to do some Afghani kids would be amazing. Mm-hmm. Now I would take a second look about going there. I'm not saying I wouldn't go there, but I would, you know, I'd have to make sure that it was pretty safe before I went. I'd have to check things out a little bit more than perhaps I have done in the past.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting because I can really see it, especially in the latest series with the children, but that you used to work with Benetton, and I could see it. How did that work affect your work that you're doing now?
Well, I was at Fabrica, mm-hmm. and I'm now a creative on Colors magazine, so I've been doing that.
So Fabrica is a part of Benetton.
Yeah, they have this creative research center in northern Italy. So I've kind of had an ongoing relationship with them all the way through, and they gave me the kind of opportunity to do some projects that, particularly with colours, you know, which have enabled me to travel and to see things. And I think a lot of the other work has come from that.
And then I know you do commercial work and you do your books. And are your books, I'm assuming that your funding comes mostly from your commercial work. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do commercial work because I think I do commercial editorial in my books, a kind of mixture. And I don't know how else you do it, really. I mean, unless you kind of have a trust fund, you know, all of these projects are expensive. And, you know, the other way is to teach. But I find that, you know, if you can get commercial work, it's a challenge. And it actually can be quite liberating because mm-hmm. you're not, you know, with your own work, it's always about kind of, why am I doing it? What does it mean? Is this new? You know, you're kind of, there's a lot of baggage that comes with it on deciding an idea. But with commercial work, it's kind of filling a brief, and that can be, you know, that's, of course you have to think because you're thinking about the aesthetics and those choices, but it's about the practicality and going out and doing it. So I enjoy that.
You put a lot, you know, into your projects, and whether it's going without a permit or the risks that you take. And I'm just curious, you know, you talked about people doubting the Apes Project, saying you can't do this. How do you have the courage to say, you know what, I think this can work and I'm just going to go for it?
I don't know. I could see this with the apes. I could see that there were images of people holding apes. I'd seen them on programs, you know, holding the little kind of baby ones. So I knew it was possible, but, yeah, I mean, I suppose that kind of gave me the confidence. I think I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't seen those pictures, if I hadn't seen people holding them already, then I wouldn't have had the confidence to go. But that told me that it was possible.
And when you were first starting working with Fabrica, you mentioned in an interview that I saw before that there was it took a while to get running, in a sense, where you were producing work that you didn't particularly love in the beginning. I think it's really important for photographers out there to know that even people like you, when I look at your work, I think you always must have been good. But you don't start off that way. So how did you grow from in the beginning, you know, where you weren't necessarily loving your work to where you are now? And do you love your work?
How did I grow? I think that working is good in the sense that the more you can do, the more you learn from things. So the more opportunities. I begin to turn a little bit of stuff down now, but at the beginning I didn't turn anything down. You know, you're trying lots of things. And I think you slowly, it is a craft, I think. I think it comes from kind of hard work, and through the hard work in the beginning, what can give you the confidence to go on kind of in later projects.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you today on this old ferry and beautiful exhibit. And okay. I look forward to seeing the next James Mollison project.
Okay. Thank you very All much. Right. Thank you.
And here's an image of James and his wife's baby, the two-month-old they brought. That's not his wife. That's Julie Graham. And actually, a good connection, because her website, acurator.com, is a great photo magazine online. And James Mollison is the current show there, and those are some of the images we were showing were from acurator.com. Thank you, Julie Graham, for that. Well, I hope you've enjoyed some of the interviews we got in Norway at Kristiansund for the Nordic Light International Festival of Photography. We had so much fun, and we want to thank Morten and Annalisa and Odd Inga for making it so much fun there. We have three more interviews next week. Greg Gorman, Hollywood photographer, superstar photographer for 40 years, taking pictures of the stars. Amazing fellow. We will talk to Robert Pledge of Contact Press Images about the job of a photo editor and the future of photography. And finally, Mary Ellen Mark, a brilliant street photographer. And we'll talk to her and see some of her images. That's coming up next week on Twit Photo. We thank everybody in Kristiansund, all the wonderful people who hosted us there. Catherine and I had such a good time. It is an amazing festival. It will come back next year, and maybe we'll go back there because it was such a warm country. Thanks also. I know Mikkel Oland is watching. Thanks to Mikkel Oland for extending the invitation in the first place and for making sure that we could get there, because it was not easy. And in fact, actually, I should probably thank Hans-Peter Brotman for also making that possible. And the folks at Nokia. In fact, we're going to get him, Hans-Peter Brontmo is his name, we're going to get him on a triangulation in the future. He's in charge of innovation at Nokia and a really great guy, also was at the festival. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Twit Photo. We do the show every Tuesday afternoon, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern time on twit.tv. That's 2030 UTC. Again, tune in next week. Another great episode from Norway. Then Catherine Hall will be back with more of our wonderful photographers. You can watch the show after the fact. We make audio and video available. You probably really want to watch the video at twit.tv/. Is it photo? I think it is. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Twit Photo.